This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Of the People Speak Radio, along with my guest co-host tonight, Saeed Leghead, and our board operator, Don. Welcome, everybody. Please feel free to join us at Pal Talk by going to www.paltalk.com, downloading and installing the software, and creating a nickname. There you can join us in the virtual audience and actually interact with us and with the guests. Or listen to us via the VBSRadio.com website by clicking on any of the icons, and this is for the virtual auditorium, by clicking any of the icons in the upper left-hand corner of the homepage or in our site. Our guest tonight is Professor Noam Chomsky, MIT Professor of Linguistics. Professor Chomsky's political writing has created debate across the political spectrum, forming the basis for many books and articles criticizing his views and definitely, absolutely atoning everything that he does. This, however, never overshadows his illustrious career in the field of linguistics. Professor Chomsky is credited with the creation of the theory of generative grammar, considered to be one of the most significant contributions in the field of theoretical linguistics made in the 20th century. Well, among many other accomplishments, which we, I'm sure, will come out through the course of the show. Hello, Mr. Chomsky. How are you?
Fine.
Thank you for being with us tonight, and we'll be right back after these announcements.
Okay.
Did you know that President Bush's No Child Left Behind Act mandates that public high schools turn over private student information to military recruiters or risk losing federal funding? Not only that, but the Pentagon has compiled a database of over 30 million young people up to age 17 for the purpose of military recruitment. You can protect your child from unwanted military recruiting by removing their names off both these lists. Go to www.leavemychildalone.org.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
Hello, everybody. We're back with our guest, Professor Noam Chomsky. Welcome to the show again, Professor. We're thrilled to have you here on The People Speak. Here on The People Speak, when the people do speak, they make a difference. We have Professor Chomsky, first of all, before we get started with any of the questions, of course, what are you doing now currently? Are you involved in any particular projects that you'd like to enlighten us on, or is there anything in particular that you have going on?
Just the usual. Existence.
Just the usual linguistics and political fervor that
right.
You generate.
You know, constant, full-time both.
Well,
and, you know, it depends what's going on. Just got back from South America a couple of weeks ago. I was giving a lot of talks there. Now back in the swing here.
Professor Chomsky, this is Saeed. I'd like to, first of all, welcome you to the room. This has been very much an anticipated event by everybody here that has heard about you coming to this room and coming to this auditorium. I'd like to welcome you again, and I have a couple of questions here, and hopefully we would make use of your time. I'd like to ask you a question first about your book, The Hegemony of Survival. You talked about America's quest for global dominance. You talked also about the economy of war in your book. Could you please explain to us how that applies to the U.S. and also the world that we are living in today?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch a few words. How what applies?
How the economy of war that you talked about in your book.
The economy of war?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, we have to be a little cautious about that. The U.S. has a, for the last, since the Second World War, has had not so much a war economy as a preparation for war economy.
Okay.
So there's a huge military system, what President Eisenhower famously called the military-industrial complex, which remains, and it's in part a system for controlling the world. It's in part a system of sustaining and developing the domestic economy. So, for example, take what we're using right now, the internet and computers. They came out of the military system for decades. In fact, most of the research and development was done essentially within under Pentagon funding and sponsorship. So-called private corporations were involved, but essentially learning from the state-supported developments at places like where I work, MIT. And most of the economy, the advanced economy, works like that. So that's one function of the preparation for war economy, and the other function is intervention, threats, waving your fist to ensure that the world is run the right way, sometimes using power. And that continues. It's taken on a special form under the current administration, which is unusual in its aggressive militarism, so unusual as to have elicited unprecedented protest and criticism, even from right within the mainstream. But not really that far off the spectrum, just at an extreme end of it. And yeah, this has been going on since the Second World War.
Yeah, do you think that the emergence of other powers, such as China, for example, is going to somewhat one day offset, if you want, this balance of power, that it would be tilting slowly, maybe in the direction of Asia? Do you believe that that will happen one of these days?
Well, prediction of the future is a very risky proposition. It has a very poor record in the past, and undoubtedly will today. But if you look over a slightly longer sweep, we can see pretty well what's happening. So just take the post-war period, post-World War II period. That did mark a substantial change in world affairs, the Second World War. The U.S. had been the most powerful economy in the world for a long time, but it was not a major player, global actor. It dominated its own region. There were forays into the Pacific, but it had moved into the Middle East when oil was discovered and wanted its share of that. But the main global force was actually Britain and France alongside it. The United States was one, but not the major one. The Second World War changed all that. The other industrial societies were either destroyed or severely damaged. The U.S. gained economically in the war enormously. Industrial production probably almost quadrupled. The U.S. ended up, at the end of the war, 1945, the U.S. had literally half the world's wealth, which is completely without precedent history, had enormous military power, unbelievable security. It controlled the whole hemisphere, controlled both oceans, controlled the opposite sides of both oceans. And it intended to use this power during the war years. High-level planners, State Department, Council on Foreign Relations, specialists and others did have regular study sessions in which they planned for the post-war period, and they planned to establish a global system in which the U.S. would be dominant, and the global system would be organized for the benefit of U.S.-based corporate systems. It would be an open world economy, which they, since they had overwhelming power, they would dominate, and the U.S. would not permit others to challenge that power. That was the basic thesis of wartime planning. to the extent possible. Of course, it wasn't 100% at that time. Over the years, that's changed. The industrial powers recovered. The Third World underwent decolonization. Around 1970, the U.S. share of world wealth had declined to about 25% from 50%. And the U.S. was one of three major economic centers. One was U.S.-based North America. The second was Europe, mostly German-based Europe. The third was rising Asia, at that time Japan-based. Well, since then, things have changed further. The as you mentioned, China has greatly increased its economic power. It's still a very dependent country. Its exports are, to a large extent, foreign-owned, for example, and has enormous internal problems. India's recovering from centuries of colonialism and recovery from colonialism. It's worth remembering that if you go back to the 18th century, centers of the centers of production, commerce, trade, most advanced areas in public health and so on were Asia, with China and India, even also Japan. Japan probably had higher life expectancy than Britain at that time. And that's, the wheels are turning. That's beginning to slowly return. By now, the United States is still it's a tripolar world. There's one of the U.S. North America, U.S.-based North America is one of the three major economic centers, and more or less on a par. Europe, Asia, now not just Japan-based, but Japan, China, South Korea, major industrial power now, India developing.
Professor, in light of all of these economic truths that are coming out and the understanding that we are, this is not only beneficial in every way for the United States, but also economically, and the Democratic Party's recent grandiose landslide win to take over the House and the Senate. We have an issue here of multi-level wars that are coming up. Do you think that the illegal war in Iraq, that we will actually see a withdrawal of troops on behalf of Americans, or do you think it's going to be more of a ceremonial lateral movement of troops? After all, when you're talking about economics, we have to understand that we have every intention of perhaps attacking Iran or engaging somehow with Iran. It seems awfully comical for us to withdraw troops just to redeploy them in such a short period of time. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say that this period has been beneficial to the United States. Depends who you mean in the United States. The majority of the population...
Exactly.
Yeah, for the majority of the population, the last... roughly 30 years have probably been the worst period of American economic history. Go back 30 years, as you would expect in the richest country in the world, the United States had the highest wages, the lowest work hours. By now that's virtually, in the industrial world, by now that's pretty much reversed, as the lowest wages almost the
And yet at the same time our corporations... Some of the highest profits in history.
Yeah, very high profits for a small percent of the population. Mm-hmm. It's been a bull, but for the majority of the population, real wages have stagnated or often declined. Has never happened before over a long period with no serious depression, no wars, but not serious ones for the economy and so on. So that's a terrible period of the economy. And for the American population, the wars are certainly no benefit. They may benefit those who want to control the world's energy supplies, but that's not, and so on. But that's not for the benefit of you and me. That's not how state policy is made.
Do you believe that there is ever going to be a total withdrawal, considering that this is so profitable and beneficial to them?
Right. There's an awful lot of talk about withdrawal, but none of it is really serious unless it faces up to a central problem that is very much on the minds of U.S. planners and their counterparts elsewhere. If the U.S. were to withdraw from Iraq and to leave a sovereign, independent, more or less democratic Iraq, that could turn into a nightmare for U.S. planners, and they know it. The Iraq was invaded, not to establish democracy, none of that. That's all fabrication. We're supposed to believe that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq, even if it was exporting lettuce and asparagus and the world's energy resources were in the South Pacific. But you have to be a really dedicated ideologue to believe that. Iraq was invaded because it's right at the center of the world's major oil resources. It has probably the second largest oil resources in the world itself. They're very easily accessible. It was one part of the oil-producing region that the U.S. didn't control, which is unacceptable, so they invaded it. They hoped to impose a client state. Well, it turned into a huge military catastrophe. They don't know what to do with it. But to withdraw would leave an independent country, Shiite-dominated, if it's moderately democratic. Its policies are pretty predictable. It would move towards closer relations with Shiite Iran, in fact, already doing so. There's a Shiite population in Saudi Arabia right across the border, which has been bitterly repressed by the U.S.-backed tyranny. They're pressing for rights. The more Iraq regains some degree of sovereignty, the more they press for maybe autonomy. That happens to be where most of Saudi oil is. Saudi Arabia is the major oil producer. Well, you could imagine, it's not a far-out imagination. You could easily imagine a loose Shiite alliance controlling most of the world's oil and independent of the United States, which would be an unthinkable nightmare. And it would get even worse if it, as is not unlikely, linked up with the China-Russia-based Asian energy security system that's now developing. Iran is already informally linked to it, and China is making trade and even trade inroads into Saudi Arabia, the Washington's oldest and most valued ally in the region because of its enormous resources. Withdrawal would very likely have such consequences, which would be of extraordinary significance for U.S. power in the world. And therefore, it's not likely to happen unless there's very significant pressure for it in the United States. One thing we can be sure of, unless these issues are considered seriously, talk about withdrawal is pretty empty talk, because those are the concerns that those are the major concerns for planners, and for obvious reasons, because of ideological controls or submission. We don't talk much about it. You can't find discussion of this, but surely these are the central issues you have to think about. Right now, the U.S. is building military bases, quite a few, apparently quite big ones, in Iraq. They don't call them permanent, but they're surely intended to be permanent. Any kind of what they would like to see is a stable client regime which would defer to the United States but would run its own affairs with U.S. forces in the background in case anything goes wrong.
Professor Chomsky, speaking of that, how much of an honest broker has the U.S. become in the last 6 years or 8 years? And what would it take if you want to restore that faith, if you want that the U.S. has always enjoyed in the past, vis-a-vis if you want the Arab world and the Muslim world? Thank you.
Honest broker with respect to what?
With respect, if you want to, how it is conducting the war itself, how it is bringing democracy to...
The U.S. has no interest in bringing democracy to the Arab world or anywhere else. And of course, everyone talks. That's the constant refrain but just take a look at the record. I mean, take a look right now at Palestine, for example. There was a free election last January in Palestine. Everyone closely monitored. Everyone agrees it was a free election. The wrong side won. How did the U.S. respond? The U.S., we're supposed to like democracy. The U.S. and Israel responded by severe punishment of the Palestinians for having voted the wrong way. They tightened the stranglehold, which was already very tight, on the Palestinians. Israel, with U.S. backing, escalated its military strikes, at its economic controls. It withheld, illegally withheld taxes. It even cut off water to the arid Gaza Strip, where water is extremely scarce. This is purposeful punishment of the population, severe punishment for voting the wrong way in a free election.
Exactly. Professor Chomsky, can I ask you something? With the reasoning behind the disproportionate support of the State of Israel is that it's an ally. That's acceptable. I mean, we understand that we do have to have allied forces in the grand scale of the world. However, what is the vested interest of the United States of America in securing the hilltops of Palestine? And how is this...
In doing what?
In securing the hilltops of Palestine, or the systematic and continued expansion of the state of... How does that benefit the United States of America?
Well,
what is the benefit in it?
If you ask how it benefits the people of the United States, it doesn't benefit them at all. For most of the... certainly Muslim world, in fact, most of the world, that's regarded as one of the main threats to peace in the world. That's one of the reasons why, if you take U.S. Arab allies, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, etc., overwhelmingly they regard the United States and Israel as the major threats to them. And it's primarily because of the crushing of the Palestinians. So it is a policy that the U.S. has followed since 1967 with very little change. There are a few changes, but not much. The current administration, as in other respects, is extreme in this respect. But it has regarded Israel as a, what's called a strategic asset. By now, it's virtually an offshore U.S. military base and high-tech center, very closely linked to the U.S. economy.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
Well, take a look at it. You know, it's
exactly.
And the U.S. leaders, U.S. political leadership, has decided pretty systematically. There are a few change exceptions, but not many. Pretty systematically to support Israeli takeover of valuable lands and resources, and to essentially crush the Palestinians. There's a rare and unusual front-page story on the New York Times today describing what has been known for a long time. They had some new details about how the majority, the large majority of the land taken over is probably illegally, is privately owned. That's illegal even by U.S. standards. What they don't point out in the article, or sort of marginally mentioned, is that any settlement at all in the occupied territories is illegal. It's a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions. Even the U.S. formally has agreed to that. The World Security Council has repeatedly condemned it, sometimes with the U.S. voting with, sometimes abstaining. The International Court of Justice, the World Court, decided in an important decision that to which the U.S. Justice agreed, incidentally, that any part of the so-called separation wall that is there to protect Israeli settlers is ipso facto illegal because the settlements are illegal in the first place. Now, you read the Times this morning, it's not only, as it has been all along, completely illegal, but it's even taking over private land, which both the U.S. and Israel say is illegal. Well,
I ask you something.
Yeah.
Are you an anti-Semite?
Why? How could... I'm Jewish. How can I be an anti-Semite?
And the reason I asked you this is because you have actually been called an anti-Semitic individual by the powers that be. And you don't consider yourself one. Why do you suppose they would label you with that?
Well, I mean, you're asking me that question is about like my asking you, do you consider yourself a child abuser?
Exactly.
People don't ask questions like that.
Well,
if anyone wants to make that,
that's the statement.
Yeah,
that
okay.
You have been called anti-Semitic.
Right, and we know exactly why. It was explained years ago, quite frankly, by a leading Israeli diplomat, a distinguished diplomat, Abba Eban, highly respected. He wrote in an American Jewish journal, I think it must have been the late 70s, that mm-hmm. the task of Zionists in the United States is to show that any criticism of Zionism, by which he meant criticism of the policy of the State of Israel, any such criticism is either anti-Semitism or Jewish self-hatred. Okay, that rules out 100% of criticism. Yeah, it's understandable that spokesman for a state would
and
say that.
And that's why I asked the question, sir. And
that's
your intelligence. But there's so much ambiguity in being a linguistic.
There's
none at all.
Anti-Semitism
agree.
Is something quite serious. I mean, I know about it.
Okay.
Fortunately, it's virtually disappeared in the United States.
Though
it was quite serious not too long ago. And to make a charge like that is a very serious charge. And it requires
is indeed.
Evidence.
And how do you respond to people that make charges like that, considering you are Jewish?
The same way you would respond if somebody said you're a child abuser. Tell them to get lost.
Yeah.
If they have some evidence, give it. Otherwise, shut up.
Exactly.
That's a very good answer, Professor Chomsky. That would bring us to the next answer here. What would you attribute the rise of religious fanaticism in the world, and probably more particularly in America, the evangelist movement
and
so forth?
It's an important and frightening development. It's happening for different reasons in different places. So in the Muslim world, for example, it's the result of the collapse of secular nationalism. You go back not too many years, the major forces in the Arab and Muslim worlds were secular nationalist forces. They were crushed in part because of their own internal failures, in part just by outside force. And people don't just say, okay, you know, our efforts to free ourselves are over, so we'll cut our throats. They turn to something else. One of the things they turned to was religious extremism for parts of the world. Furthermore, that was fostered by the West and indeed by Israel. So Israel fostered Hamas. It's the predecessors of Hamas. They fostered them as in opposition to the secular nationalism represented by the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, which wanted to negotiate a political settlement, which they didn't want. And in response, they supported religious fundamentalists and ended up with Hamas on their hands. Hezbollah is the result of the U.S.-backed Israeli occupation of Lebanon, 22 mm-hmm. years in violation of Security Council orders, very brutal, and it led to resistance, which is led by Hezbollah. And that's been true quite commonly. In the United States, it's a different story. The United States has always been an extremely religious fundamentalist society. It goes back to the colonists, and there have been repeated great awakenings, upsurges of religious extremism. The most recent one was in the 1950s, in fact. It was quite serious. You go back and you read the statements of presidents in the late 1940s and the early 50s, it doesn't sound very different from George Bush. That has always been there as a large part of American society, maybe a third, 40% of American society. There's no other country in the world that I know of where about half the population believes that the world was created 6,000 years ago as it is now, and that the fossils were placed there by God and so on. I mean, that's
yeah, Professor
very,
Chomsky. We
like
have
that.
We have a question from the audience here.
Sorry?
Professor, we have a question from the audience, and it is from Spain. The question is from Camino Solo, and he's asking, will the Democrats come up with a new plan in Iraq and the Arab world? This is a question from Spain for you, Professor.
There's no indication of that. I mean, maybe different in nuance, but they basically are committed to the same programs. In fact, in many cases, are more extreme. The Democrats have often been more extreme in supporting Israeli oppression of Palestinians than the Republicans have been, often. With regard to Iraq, the Democrats made no significant proposals and are making none now. They're not a genuine opposition party. They don't represent the public opinion, the majority of public opinion, on a host of major issues, including these.
Well, we do have to take a break right now, Professor, but before we do, we have a little giveaway contest that we usually try to incorporate into our show. And tonight we'll be giving away one of Professor Noam Chomsky's books. The question for is pretty simple, but you have to be the third one to answer it. And our admins, and this is only for the audience participation in our virtual auditorium, and we have dozens and dozens and dozens of people in the auditorium today, Professor, just so you'll know, and they're all very excited about this. The contest question for tonight is, what is Professor Chomsky's doctorate in? And the first person to answer that question will receive one of the Professor Chomsky's books. And we'll be right back. As soon as we come back, hopefully we'll have a winner, and I'll announce the winner's name. And we'll be taking a short break, and we'll be back with Professor Chomsky in just a few minutes. You're here listening to The People Speak, and when the people speak, we make a difference.
Hi, this is Randy Rhodes. You know, when Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held serious bipartisan investigations that did result in articles of impeachment. He resigned before he could be impeached, but strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war, lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court orders, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, tortured, used illegal weapons, and targeted civilians. Ask your Congress member to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Millions of people are doing it on Pal Talk already. Meet new friends, see and be seen on webcams, and share files. With real-time video and the ability to talk to all your AOL, MSN, Yahoo, and ICQ buddies from one list, Pal Talk has it all. Join hundreds of chat rooms or start your own. Visit www.paltalk.com today and download the new messenger for free. Pal Talk, communication beyond words.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Welcome back, everybody, to the People Speak radio show. We're here tonight with Professor Noam Chomsky of the MIT Linguistics Department. Mm-hmm. And it is a pleasure to have you here with us, sir, this evening.
Yeah, welcome back, Professor. I'd like to follow up on the previous question with another question here. Is there ever going to be a compromise between the view of democracy in the Western world vis-a-vis the view of democracy in the Muslim world? Is there ever going to be some kind of compromise between the two?
I don't see any need for a compromise. I think it's pretty much the same concept of democracy. You look back at the history of the Muslim world, there have been and remain very significant pro-democratic currents. They've often been crushed by the West. I mean, take, say, Iran, now the most extreme fundamentalist religious state is actually Saudi Arabia, the leading U.S. ally and the one that the U.S. has supported as a center of radical Islamic fundamentalism for years. But take Iran. Iran had a parliamentary democracy. has a long history. It was overthrown in 1953 by a U.S.-British coup. Okay, since then, Iran has not had a democracy. There were strong democratic currents in Iraq, even under the U.S.-backed, there is a British-backed monarchy. Well, U.S. has been opposed to them. Remember, the U.S. supported Saddam Hussein, strongly supported him, right through his worst atrocities. Right now in Egypt, there are pro-democracy movements. Kifaya, for example, is an important pro-democracy movement. The U.S. is opposing it. And we can say the same about other regions of the world. Take, say, Latin America. Repeatedly, the United States has intervened to undermine democratically elected governments that it didn't like.
Professor, what do you make of Daniel Ortega, for example, winning the primary elections in Nicaragua just a few weeks ago?
I've never been a great fan of his, to tell you the truth. The Sandinistas in the early... He was elected before, remember. He was elected in 1984 in a free election that was very closely monitored, probably at that time the most extensively monitored election in history, certified as free and fair and so on. The U.S. didn't like it, so it claims he wasn't elected, but he was. I wouldn't have voted for him then. I wouldn't now. His election shows that the... To talk about Nicaragua, you have to pay some attention to what's happened there in the last years. In the early 80s, it was a country that was full of hope and expectation and activism. And a lot of interesting things were happening. It was being highly praised by the international financial institutions, by the aid agencies, and so on. There was a lot of space open for people to do some very important things. The U.S. fought a major war to destroy that. The Contra war, the terrorist war, was no joke. Left the country in ruins. Finally, at the point of a gun, the population voted for the U.S. candidate, 1990. Since that time, it has sunk into complete misery. It's now the second poorest country in the hemisphere. It's a wreck. There are two major political groupings. One is the so-called liberals, the other is the FSLN. The leadership of both is very corrupt. They're in league with one another. They've prevented almost anything constructive from happening. I don't think the population has much of a choice.
Excellent. Professor Chomsky, we have another question from a viewer here, from Dennis DeMenis, and his question is, Dennis from Orlando, Howard Zinn is his favorite historian. Who is your favorite historian, Professor?
I'd be happy to go along with Howard Zinn, who's an old personal friend as well.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Now, could we consider America really a model of democracy in the world?
In some respects, democracy is a complicated affair. If we mean by democracy that the population has a significant voice in public policy, then the U.S. is a very poorly functioning democracy. There's an enormous gap between public opinion and public policy. Actually, there's no time to review it here, but I have a recent book, Failed States, called, in which I review a lot of the data on public opinion, and it's striking how different it is from policy. That's why U.S. elections keep away from issues. U.S. elections are pretty much run by the public relations industry, the same people who sell toothpaste on television ads, and they do it the same way. They market candidates the same way they market lifestyle drugs and automobiles. You don't give information. You construct imagery and illusion. I mean, we all know that. You don't learn anything about a product when you see a television ad for it. And you don't learn very much about a candidate when you see campaign rhetoric and advertisements and so on. What you learn is the kind of imagery they're constructing, but they keep away from the issues. And the issues are issues on which people care a lot. So it takes that for domestically speaking, the major...
And we vote in the image.
We have no choice. We have, I'll take the last presidential election. There were two candidates, both of them born to wealth and political families with wealth and political influence. Both went to the same elite university. They joined the same secret society where you train rich young men to become political leaders. They ran pretty similar programs, supported with by the same concentrations of capital, of funding. And the population literally was unaware of their issues, of their positions. There's very good studies of this. I can review them in the last book, but just to give one illustration, take, say, the global warming is a very serious matter. It's going to be catastrophic unless we do something about it. And the population agrees with that. For example, the population overwhelmingly supported the Kyoto Protocols. In fact, they supported them so strongly that a majority of Bush voters thought that he supported them. A large majority of the population for years has thought that the United States should have some kind of national health care system, like other industrial countries. Our health care system is a disaster. It has about twice the per capita costs of comparable countries and some of the worst outcomes. A huge number of people just can't get health care. They can't afford it. And people want a reasonable national health care system.
Absolutely.
Neither party will propose it. Neither party will discuss it.
It
didn't come up in the elections.
It's too big a rattlesnake. It's like putting a rattlesnake in a bag. Professor, we're being bombarded with questions here. Our next question is from the winner of your book, as a matter of fact,
okay.
Steve from the UK, who is probably one of your staunchest fans here. I've been arguing with Steve all afternoon to break down his question, so I'm afraid Steve is going to be very upset with you, but this is what I could work out.
Okay.
Most of the value we generate as participants in the competitive economy is passed up through the supply chain as price reductions to our customers and their customers, and down through the economy as increased prices paid to our suppliers. And I'm breaking this down quite a bit, considerably. Could you assess, sir, the efficacy of economic non-cooperation in this form, or even minimized cooperation, and the value of charity as an anti-competitive strategy for moving your most desperate and thus innovative competitors? That is Steve's question.
I think it's a question that interweaves a lot of interesting topics, but
exactly.
Quite frankly, I didn't understand the question. I don't see what the question is. I mean,
well, the question is, he wants you to break down the certain aspects of how the price reductions affect our customer base through and the
well,
economy.
Well, you know, price reduction is a funny term. I mean, there are some commodities where competition leads to price reduction. There are other commodities where monopoly pricing, government-imposed monopoly pricing rights sharply increase pricing. Take, say, pharmaceuticals. Why does the United States consumer pay far higher prices for life-saving drugs than in other comparable societies? Well, that's because the state requires monopoly pricing rights, which are, in fact, built into the trade agreements. And the United States is probably unique, certainly unusual, among industrial and other societies in that the government is not permitted to negotiate prices with the pharmaceutical corporations. That's banned by law. Congress banned
it. Really? That's very interesting.
Okay,
I did
so
not
that
know
raises
that.
Prices. They do it for the Veterans Administration, but they won't do
right.
it. Medicare is not allowed to do it. That's banned by law. So there's a striking case, and that's one that affects our lives, in which the state intervention sharply increases prices. And across the board, it's a very complex affair. It's not, again, go back to, say, computers and the Internet, which I mentioned before. That's a centerpiece of the economy. It did not arise from you're taught in economics courses, from entrepreneurial initiative and consumer choice. It developed largely through the state sector for decades, in fact. And
mm-hmm.
much of the rest of the economy works the same way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as simple an affair as those terms suggest. Yeah, sometimes competition, say in retailing, cuts prices. Very often the economy works by interventions of the kind that increase prices. Corporations are not in the business of charity. They're in the business of making profit. Often they do it by raising prices, by squeezing out competitors and so on.
Well, thank you very much for answering that. Our next question is from one of our audience members named Utman, and he says, my question is, what is your point of view of the U.S. offshoring a lot of their activities, mainly the industry of informational technology in India, in short, middle, and long term? We all know that in the short term, a lot of American workers are going to be losing their jobs. That's the question.
Well, that's, again, a very mixed story. So the corporations make decisions about where to produce. The workers and the corporations and the communities don't make the decisions. In a democratic society, it would be the workforce that, and the communities that make decisions about where production and distribution will be. In our society, those decisions are made by within what amount to totalitarian institutions. Corporations is about as close to a totalitarian institution as any that humans have devised. Decisions are made at the top, they're handed down. At each level, you take what comes from above and you hand it down below. The role of the population is essentially zero, except to either rent themselves as workers or to consume, but not in decision making. So, for example, when a factory is sent offshore, it could well be that it would be quite profitable at home, maybe not profitable enough to satisfy the tiny percentage of the population that owns the overwhelming amount of stock, but profitable enough for the workers in the community. Well, in that case, it could stay here. Furthermore, there are many protectionist devices. The international economic arrangements are devised in such a way as to set poor people and working people in competition with one another throughout the world. But they protect highly paid professionals. So, for example, immigration restrictions in the United States and other restrictions protect professionals from competition. So, for example, if you want to, say, appoint a professor at a university, well, you have to go through a complicated procedure trying to demonstrate that there's no person in the United States who could take that academic position. That's protectionist. It's true for lawyers, doctors, lots of skilled professionals who can protect themselves. Actually, I don't have time to talk about this, but there's a very good book about it by a very fine economist, Dean Baker, called The Conservative Nanny State. I think you can even pick it up online, in which he goes into considerable detail about the various ways in which so-called conservatives construct a nanny state, a protectionist state, to protect their interests, undermining market systems.
Well, we'll have somebody type that in the room. Go ahead, Saeed. You have a question.
Yes, Professor. Speaking about immigration, do you think, Professor, that the rise of an anti-immigrant sentiment probably that is starting to take shape in the lower southeastern states such as Arizona, New Mexico, and so forth is going to have, if you want, some kind of bearing on the voter sentiment in the next few years to come, considering that this is something that has already been probably fostered in Europe very much versus people who are coming from countries such as North Africa and the Middle East? Is this going to be the same feeling, considering that most Americans here are already immigrants themselves anyway? Thank you, Professor.
Not most Americans, but everyone except the indigenous population is an immigrant or a descendant of immigrants. And if you look through history, American history, there has consistently been very strong anti-immigrant feeling. It goes all the way through. We were talking about anti-Semitism before. I mean, plenty of Jews could have been saved from the Holocaust if they'd been admitted into the United States. But anti-immigrant feeling was so strong that was barred. It was even barred after the Second World War, when people were dying, still dying, in displaced persons camps. I mean, there were Oriental Exclusion Acts, which excluded all Orientals. The Irish, when they came in the late 19th century, were bitterly oppressed in places like Boston, where I'm talking from. And so it's been right through history. There are consistently those who sort of made it were opposed to others coming in. On the other hand, the country was built and developed by the work and creativity and dedication of the immigrants who came in. And I think that'll continue to be the case. I mean, there are real issues. We shouldn't deny it. I mean, there's conflicts of values, important values, between allowing people to move freely wherever they want to go and the right of people to somehow protect their own community. Those are often in conflict, and there are no simple answers to that. But
okay.
Any immigrant feeling is not new, and I think it should definitely be overcome.
Professor, I'm going to take you back, if you want, to the cause that you've very much, if you want, dedicated your entire life to, and everybody knows you by that, which is linguistics. I'd like to know very much, how do you feel about the diversity of languages in the world, and also the state of contemporary academia in general in the world. How do you feel about that, considering that you are by far one of the very few people that have dedicated their lives very much to linguistics in the world?
Well, speaking of the diversity of languages in the world, one of the great contemporary tragedies is the rapid disappearance of languages. But the number of languages spoken now is declining, and if these tendencies continue within a short period, the very large majority of them will have disappeared. The problem of and when we talk about a language, it's not just sort of the words and sentences that we speak. It's a culture, it's a tradition, it's communities, it's history, solidarity, cultural wealth. It's quite a rich array of phenomena that are all centered around the language is the most obvious component of that complex. And those are disappearing rapidly, not just in the Third World, but even in Europe. So, for example, there are plenty of people in Europe, say in Italy, who can't talk to their grandmother because she talks a different language.
That is correct.
The diversity, and it's a tremendous loss of cultural wealth, and it's also, just from a scientific point of view, a loss of extremely important information about what human beings are.
So, Professor, what would be the secret to keeping a language alive? And I'll give you a couple of examples. For example, I am originally from Morocco. In Morocco, we have the Amazigh language, the Berber language that is spoken by, I'd say, about 60% of the population. And we also have Moroccan Jews that have conserved their language considerably. And also Jews in Turkey. These people have very much survived despite the attempts constantly, if you want, to very much acculturate, if you want. What is the secret, in your opinion, Professor?
The secret for?
For survival of a language or a dialect.
Well, the survival of languages, and there are many of them. In fact, what's called Arabic is just a cover name for lots of different languages which are not mutually intelligible. What are called Arabic dialects are really different languages. The survival of them reflects the commitment of people to their community, to their culture, to their history, to their tradition. And sometimes languages revive. So, for example, take, say, Basque. It's reviving. It looked as if it was a dying language. Now it's a spoken language. Take, say, Welsh. You walk around the streets of Cardiff, listen to children coming out of school, they're talking Welsh. That's a reviving language. There are some dramatic examples of languages that have actually been... there are some American Indian languages, Native American languages, which have not been spoken for 100 years, but are now being revived, reconstructed. Children are learning them. Some of them are learning them as their native language. All of these things reflect the commitment of people to the society in which they live, to the social bonds that they have with one another, to the cultural wealth that's embedded in it, and so on. Human life is a complex affair.
Professor Chomsky, we have a couple of more questions we're trying to get from some of our audience members. Mitsuk from Canada would like to know why the American media do not have you on to talk as a guest on political issues more often. Is it because he is critical of that you are critical of the system, and they are part of the system of hegemony, or what reasons do you think that would be?
Canadian media are not very different. Canadian media aren't very different, I'm saying. It's not unusual that the media are, after all, systems of power. In the United States, they're mostly major corporations. Elsewhere, they're state power. And they tend to protect themselves from critical discussion. It's not me. Howard Zinn was mentioned before as a favorite historian. How often have you heard him on the radio or the television?
Yeah, very true. Not often enough, neither one of you, as far as I'm concerned. Hawkeye from New York, and he asked, does Professor think that global neo-monopolies and advanced capitalism is doomed to collapse in on itself? And Hawkeye is from Syracuse, New York.
Well, first of all, I don't like the term capitalism very much. What we have and what other societies have is some complicated Let me just finish this sentence.
Yes.
What we have is a form of state capitalism. Involving reliance on the state sector of the economy, a lot of state protection, state intervention in the private system. It's a mixed story. As to what its future will be, we can't say. It has destructive properties. One can hope that a more functional democratic society will overcome those.
Professor, I'd like to ask you one last question.
I'm afraid we're out of time, sorry. Thank you very much for being with us this evening, Professor. I just want everybody to know that next week, Aaron Russo, producer of the film America, Freedom, from Freedom to Fascism. I'm sorry, it was written incorrectly. And I'm looking forward to everybody being here next week. Thank you, Professor, again. Thank you, Saeed, for being my guest co-host this evening. And thank you to our guest audience and our Pal Talk audience. You guys have been great as usual. We'll see you all next week at Pal Talk and The People Speak. And when we speak, we make a difference. Thank you very much, Professor.
Very glad to be with you.
Thank you, Professor, again for the time that you took.
Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the table by the relief of death, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.